It's just after 12 o'clock, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, listener-sponsored radio in Western Canada. And speaking of being listener-sponsored, we would like to thank all of the people who called to support Co-op Radio in our recent marathon fundraising drive. We didn't do too badly. If you did call in and support Co-op Radio and you haven't sent in your membership yet, don't forget to do that. It's really important that we get the money so we can pay the bills. Anyway, it is now time for Animal Voices here on Co-op Radio. So bring on the animals and we will introduce you to a whole other world.
Welcome to Animal Voices. This show comes to you through the cooperative efforts of three local groups, Vancouver Humane Society, Earth Save Canada, and Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection. Ideas expressed on this show are not necessarily those of these organizations. My name is Marge Adams. With me in the studio are technician Alan Jensen and co-hosts John Pranger and Carl Loskin. Our guest on today's show is Crystal Parks, who is an animal activist living in Denver, Colorado. She dedicates herself to saving elephants, a species which is under tremendous pressure from loss of habitat, poaching, hunting, and relentless encroachment by humans. She will be telling us about pachyderms and her enduring effort to save them. During the hour, we will also be discussing several topics, including another mad cow found in Delta, praying mantis insects for sale at Costco, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's desire to remove the labeling of irradiated foods. So we'll start with our discussion part of the show, and I'm going to ask Carl Loskin to tell us about the mad cow found in Delta. Will you do that, Carl?
Yes, you know, I'd like to start off with a quote from Richard, who is one of the hosts on the Community Living show, and he said, "Why do cows wear bells?" So I didn't know what the answer was, and he said, "Because their horns don't work." Thank you, Richard, for that one. Well, I wish that the federal government and the provincial government could make more sense out of what has been an ongoing saga with the mad cow epidemic. Because this past Wednesday, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency put out a statement that another cow in the Fraser Valley here had been infected with the mad cow disease.
That was a dairy cow, right?
That was a dairy cow. And what the headline said, by the way, the Globe and Mail had an article which was about 2 inches long about the cow. The Vancouver Sun had a fairly larger article with this headline: "Sick cow didn't enter food system." As if that was the main concern. I believe, John, I know you're quite familiar with this, that many of the inconsistencies, some of the things that absolutely don't make sense, continue to this day, even though there has been so many warnings. We continue in Canada to feed animals to cows. Cows are herbivores. We should not be feeding them animal products. And now, John, maybe you can just tell us what it's apparently milk replacer. What's in milk replacer?
Oh, that's blood.
blood is replacing milk and is dried and then sprayed over the feed of the calf, and that is what it gets for nutrients. Now, this cow was born after the ban had been put in place. However, the ban against feeding cows chicken litter is still there. So these cows have been eating carcasses.
The cows are eating carcasses from other animals, and especially something they call milk replacer. Why do they call it milk replacer? Because when the cows are born, when the calves are born, they take the babies away from their mothers. Can you imagine your baby being taken away from you?
And fed blood?
And the day after you're born, the baby is born, and then put in, if it's a male, it goes into a veal crate. And then, as you say, John, being fed blood from slaughtered pigs. Now, it is so horrendous.
Laughable, but so...
A few years ago, I was on CKNW, and I spoke to the Minister of Agriculture at that time with on open air, and I told them, we have to stop practicing these unnatural practices of feeding animals to cows. If we want to eradicate in a meaningful way diseases from animals being passed on to humans, and to my mind, basically threatening the health of the people who are consuming these animal products. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that chickens don't come down with mad cow disease. It hasn't been shown. We also know that pigs don't come down. But they harbor this. They could be harboring, and it's been shown in some experiments, they do harbor this infectious agent. Mm-hmm. And then even though they don't come down with it, if the animal then, the cow then feeds this from an infected animal, it will come down with it. So it's an absolutely critical case, and there's no end in sight.
And sometimes the symptoms don't show. So, in fact, these animals will get into the food chain. There's absolutely no question about that. And to say that we have stopped this, and that is a proof of how good and stable our system is in catching these abnormalities, that's not true at all. Because animals are being passed inspection that are diseased.
Now, in the United States, they claim that they're having a more rigorous system of testing for mad cow disease. But the statement that I read, it said they're only testing for downer cows.
Yes.
Now, what is a downer cow, John?
Well, that's a cow who can no longer stand up, but anything between that and perfect health is not defined, is it?
That's correct, and it might not show the symptoms, and also that a downer cow is one that is down.
In fact, the last
cannot stand up.
The last cow that was discovered to be sick was not showing symptoms of BSE, but symptoms of tuberculosis or something, and so it was culled and tested, and lo and behold, that is what we found. So an asymptomatic cow passed inspection because there was nothing to see except the tuberculosis. And so the cows are, in fact, going into the food chain, and people are consuming BSE cows.
Yeah. Let's go on now. We better not spend too much time.
But I want to know what the minister said in response.
Oh, okay.
The minister said it would be uneconomic to make these changes.
Good for the minister. It's
good for the minister.
Mm-hmm. He's thinking with his...
with
whatever.
His hand in his back pocket. Well, anyway, thanks to the people who listen to Animal Voices, and we've heard Howard Lyman speak about No More Bull in his book, and we've also seen the studies from Pittsburgh, and I think from the other, is it Tufts or Cornell, which showed that people were actually coming down with mad cow disease, but it wasn't with
Creutzfeldt-Jakob,
but it wasn't being diagnosed as such.
No.
And we had a case many years ago in North Vancouver of a woman who came down with the mad cow disease, and I challenged the authorities to study this and give me the report. I'd like to know how she contacted it. And they came back to me and said, it's a non-communicable disease. So anyway, we don't get any better here. But on a lighter note, Marge wants me to go on with some other news that we have. Mm-hmm. I live on the North Shore. I get the North Shore news. And there was a very interesting article was written there about, which was quite new to me, that Bowen Island residents are up in arms over Costco's website sale of praying mantis egg casings as a garden insect controller. Hmm. Well, this somebody, a local artist and a lifelong Bowen resident, said that praying mantis could disturb local ecosystems because she believes it is an invasive species. The mantis, she said, could upset a natural cycle if it devours insects that are essential to the diets of other animals. We need the balance of animals we have, she said. And obviously she meant when you throw in some indiscriminate predator like a praying mantis, they eat everything and they take over the habitat of one of those or a bunch of those species, thereby totally altering the balance of the ecosystem, and it can cause huge problems. So thank you for the North Shore News for that interesting article. And I know time rides down the trail when we're having fun, and you want me to talk about irradiation of food. Mm-hmm. And here we go back to the venerable cow, and that the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, basically has proposed a new federal regulation, that's in the United States, that will allow manufacturers and retailers to sell controversially irradiated foods without labeling them.
Now, this is the case in Canada right now, I believe, isn't it?
Yes, and you know what they have when food is irradiated, mm-hmm. they have a little sunshine with a smiling person on that. But let's have a look at why we're irradiating foods. Why are we irradiating animal products? Because, and what is it doing to the food that we do? Because it's cesium-90, which is a byproduct of the nuclear industry, and they found a use for it. But what's happening is that we've had this epidemic of diseases from, I guess it comes from the slaughterhouse where the fecal matter is spread over the chickens. You know, mm-hmm. when the machine goes into the intestine, into the vent of the chicken and hauls out the intestines and all the goodies inside there. It's somewhat of an inexact science, and often the intestines are burst and the fecal matter is splashed all over the chicken itself. Now, washing, as was previously done, which was always still being done, is not sufficient to destroy these E. coli and virulent other bacteria that are inherent.
And the cancers and the tumors.
These bacteria are inherent in the intestines of the animals. They splashed all over these animals, the cattle, the chickens, the pigs. Now, if we irradiate them, we can leave this fecal matter on the flesh itself, but we will destroy the E. coli and the bacteria. So that's why They want to irradiate all the food now. That's why there is the thrust to make the flesh of animals safe for people to eat. And this leaves the other very vital question is, what is it doing to the molecules? The molecules and the food we're eating. And we're also irradiating foods from India, from Thailand, from China now. Vegetables and fruits. I believe we have an inherent right to know not only what's in our food, but how it is treated. And when the FDA seeks to remove the labeling that these foods have been irradiated, I feel this is a tremendous infringement on my right to know. Mm-hmm. And I also believe it's an infringement on the quality of the food that people eat. Because I don't believe we know what is happening on a molecular level.
Mm-hmm. The same thing is true of genetically modified food, right? It's the same thing. It's the same type of problem. We don't know what the consequences are for playing around with genetics this way and ending up with genetically modified food. And it, too, is not being labeled properly. I mean, I want to know if it's genetically modified, but the government of Canada refuses to step in and make regulations to do with genetic modification.
Primarily, I suppose, to favor the business and keep them afloat.
Oh, for sure. I mean, they know that people might not pick up an item if there's a little symbol on it that says genetically modified. Like in Europe, it's marked. You know, all food that is genetically modified that is sold in Europe has a symbol of some sort on it. But in North America, it's not happening.
I wonder what impact that has had on sales in Europe. Has it cut down on GMOs sales?
Consumption
or not?
Of American imports and so on. That,
they won't import.
You can be sure that the Americans are over in Europe trying to do whatever they can to get the
arms.
European community, breaking arms indeed, to get the European community to get rid of regulations like this because, first of all, it interferes with the export of American foods. Secondly, they don't want this sort of symbolic stance that Europe is making to start influencing American thinking, right? And so, without a doubt, I can just imagine the sort of high-level arm-twisting that's going on in Europe around this issue. But both what Carl is talking about with food irradiation and around the genetic modification these are serious things.
And on the flimsiest evidence, the government maintains that the government maintains that there is no difference between genetically modified food and conventionally grown food. Well, that shows you how unscientific they really are.
I wonder, are GMOs produced in Europe, or are they just not grown?
They have them, but they have to label them.
I see.
Okay. Now, last night I was at a meeting in North Vancouver, in the district of North Vancouver, where we're trying to put forward a meaningful bylaw to limit pesticides, which has been a pet subject of mine for a long time. And there was a physician who showed a graph. He said, look at this graph. And we put these people on organic food, and instantly you saw the number of pesticides in the urine decrease. Just amazing when I saw that chart because we were so riddled. But I'd like to also talk about a good fellow from the Buck Suzuki Foundation, a fellow called David, who was on the show last night. He was one of the speakers there, including from the Cancer Association. And he said that he was talking about our primary sewage system and of course that the sewage from 70,000 up to 75,000 households on the North Shore goes through the primary process underneath the Lions Gate Bridge. And then what primary means is that they stir it up, break down the solids, take out the solids that are there, and then let it settle. some 50% of all the feces from 76,000 households in the North Shore settle down on the ground, and they take it out. But that also means that some 50% of the fecal matter from all these households on the North Shore goes into the ocean, and it gets chlorinated, of course, and broken down. The toilet paper is taken out, but it goes into the ocean underneath the Lion's Gate Bridge. And I said to him, I said, I always see these fish boats underneath the Lion's Gate Bridge where all this billions of liters of primary treated sewage is going into the inlet, and it's going up Indian Arm. And I said to him, do you think that these fishermen who are fishing there at the mouth of the Capilano River, where the sewage also goes in, ever consider that these fish, while they're waiting to go upstream, are swimming in a cesspool of sewage?
Thank you for that, Carl. Now we have our guest on the line, Crystal Parks. Now, I'll tell you a little bit about her. Crystal was a peace activist and an international human rights activist for 2.5 decades before switching her focus. Since then, she has spent much of her time and energy working to improve lives of various species, but now she concentrates on the pachyderms, or the elephants. Last year, she spent 12 days on a water-only hunger strike while sitting outside a circus grounds protesting against a circus coming to town. Well, one result of that was Crystal lost 13 pounds. Water only for 12 days, imagine. Now, welcome. Are you there, Crystal?
Yes.
Yes, you can hear me. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Well, thank you.
Wonderful to have you with us.
Thank you.
Perhaps we could start out, Crystal, by having you tell what were the successes from your hunger strike.
Okay. Well, the first thing that was amazing to me, and which I had not really expected, was that I got to talk to a lot of children. Usually when we protest at circles with signs and so forth, the people going to the circus just rush by. But to see me in a cage, the kids came over and would ask me what I was doing. So I was able to really communicate a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing that happened was there was a woman who was on her way to attend the circus, and she saw me there in the cage. She came running over to me. I actually thought she was going to spit at me. But she actually was interested in knowing what I was doing. And so I spoke to her about the situation with the animals in the circus, in particular the elephants. And so she tore up her ticket and didn't go. And now she's active, you know, in her area of Colorado against circuses.
Oh, so that certainly was some achievement. I'm sure you increased awareness of the situation within the circus.
There was a lot of media coverage about it, which, you know, is always very helpful when the media comes out. So there were newspaper articles, talk shows were talking about the hunger strike, and I got a lot of emails from people across the world internationally, so...
Oh, wonderful. Did you notice, or maybe you weren't aware of the attendance at the circus? I would hope that it was cut down to some extent anyway.
Well, you know, it will be a lifelong battle to get the animals out of Ringling Brothers Circus.
I understand that if you did such a thing today, you possibly could end up in jail for causing economic damage. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, but there is some kind of law like that. However, I did protest at a circus this last weekend, so...
So you didn't get any police attention?
No.
Good. Now, tell us, will you, Crystal, what caused you to focus your attention on elephants? Because you were more diversified before that, I understand.
Well, I decided a couple of things. One was that to be effective, I felt I needed to focus and go deep rather than broad.
Oh.
The other thing was who elephants are. They are just so magnificent, so highly evolved, so loving, compassionate, caring, humorous, and in great peril. Their situation is very, very grave.
We're having a little bit of trouble on the line, Crystal.
Yeah.
Are you on a cell phone?
No.
Oh, and I don't, that's usually what the problem is, but I don't, it seemed to get any feedback kind of.
I know, I hear that too. Let me, is that better?
Just a minute, would you speak up
yes.
again?
Is that better?
Yes. It's, yeah, somewhat better. Thanks
okay.
for that. Okay.
Okay.
Now, you talked about them being compassionate, and you talked about them being humorous. Give us an example, will you?
Oh, I have so many examples. One is in regards to compassion. Elephants have the capacity in times of drought and very hot temperatures, they have the capacity to put their trunk down in their stomach and pull out water and squirt themselves to cool themselves off.
Hmm.
Of course, it's, you know, life-saving. That would be, just a life-saving measure for them to do that. And I have on video the clip of an elephant walking along and discovering another elephant who is actually lying down, dying from the heat, and so the elephant digs a little hole with her foot, about the size of, you know, a small bowl, reaches into her stomach and pulls out water and fills the little hole with her own life-saving water so that this other elephant who is dying from the heat can get some water.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, isn't that it? And so they have that kind of compassion, but not only to their own. They extend that to other species. Another story is about a baby rhino was in a puddle of mud and couldn't get out, and the mother rhino was trying to get it out but wasn't successful, and an elephant came along and saw that this was happening and started to help get the rhino out of the mud puddle. And the mother rhino, not understanding the intentions of the elephant, started to attack the elephant.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine that doesn't feel too good to be attacked with, you know, the horn of a rhino. But the elephant did not stop until she got the baby out.
How did she do that? With her trunk?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they used their trunk and then their tusks. And so, and then another story of an elephant was walking along a path, and they don't really quite see too good, but they really have strong ability to sense things under their feet. So it was walking along, it could sense that right under its foot, there was a tortoise walking across the road. And instead of stepping on it, the elephant put its foot to the side to avoid hurting the tortoise.
Lovely. The other thing that fascinates me about what I've heard about elephants is that they can hear over a very great distance, 5 miles or to 20 miles, depending on who's telling the story. But how does that work?
Well, they have a vibration. It's called low frequency or infrasound. And so they can communicate, long distances with this infrasound, and up to 10 kilometers. And they can vibrate through their feet. So they have these amazing abilities. So when a herd is being slaughtered, they can communicate this tragedy, to other herds in the area.
Will they actually go to help? The other herds, come in to help?
I don't know.
No, okay.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But one amazing thing about the bottom of their feet that are kind of like seismographs is during a time of drought, they can actually feel if there's water underneath the ground. And what's amazing is not only can they feel that there's water there, but they can also feel how far down the water is. So that if the water is further down than their trunk is long, they won't waste their energy digging a hole.
Ah, I see. Amazing. Now, their habitats are restricted, aren't they, to Southeast Asia and Africa?
Well, there's like 13 Asian countries and where they live, and 30-something African countries where they live.
I see. Now, I know that you went to Thailand, and I'm sure there must be elephants there.
Yeah, the elephants in Asia are very different. Their situation is very different than African elephants, and that's because Asian elephants are domesticated. So they go through this horrendous process called the crushing box. And it is that what they do is they take a young elephant and they put it in a crate so that it cannot move, and then they beat it with boards that have nails in the bottom, and they beat it and they beat it, and they deprive it of food and water, and they don't stop beating it in this manner, and they hit all the sensitive parts. They even will beat the inner ear. And they do this until the elephant actually collapses.
What's the point of doing that?
To make them docile.
Hmm.
To make them docile.
Scare them.
And what happens is with these elephants, that's just the beginning. Their whole life is one of being beaten. The mahouts, which are the people who own the elephants, mostly use cruelty to get them to do what they want.
And they're used as labor, aren't they?
They're used as labor. They're used to beg in the big cities. They're used to give tourist rides. They're kind of in our country we have horses. Well, in Asia they have elephants.
I see. Oh, when you break the horse, don't you? You don't gentle him. You break him. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, what I wanted to tell you, Marge, too, is about this the crushing box is. 40% of the elephants die from it, and another 40% actually go insane. And they will commit suicide, if you can imagine. They will step on their trunk, or they will jump over a cliff as a result of this horrendous torture. And some mother elephants who, in the elephant community, and the elephants are extremely, extremely tight-knit. They love each other. They're the families. All the females live together their whole lives. The mothers, the babies, the aunts, the sisters, they all live together their entire life. And yet, a mother elephant in Asia is known to kill its baby to prevent it from going through the crushing box. Mm.
Now, you were in Thailand. Were you an observer, or were you doing some work to try and change the situation? Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I was working in an elephant sanctuary north of Chiang Mai. Chiang Mai is the second biggest city in Thailand, working with a woman named Lek, who is an elephant activist. She's a Thai woman who has saved 30 elephants. 30 elephants are in her sanctuary, and she is working very, very hard to try to educate the Thai people that they can train their elephants with love and kindness. They don't have to use these horrendous methods. Mm-hmm. So she's working very hard to do that. But what I learned from her is that there's a new trend in Africa, which I wanted to bring up, and that is that now some tour agencies in Africa, especially in the southern African countries, want to start using elephants for elephant safaris. And by that I mean, you instead of going out to look at wild animals in a Land Rover, you go out on an elephant, or use elephants to give tourist rides. So I asked Lek if she knew what training methods the Africans were going to are going to use to domesticate the African elephant for these purposes. And she told me that she was well aware of what they were doing because Africans had hired mahouts from Sri Lanka and from Thailand to teach them how to do the crushing box.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And Lek had told the Africans, you don't have to use the crushing box. You can use love and kindness. And they said, but it takes too long.
Oh, well, there's such a loss of life. What do they get? About 20% of the elephants survive. So
yeah.
that's a pretty big loss, it seems to me. And anyway, now there's a. I know in parts of the world there's a ban on ivory, and there's some effort to overturn that ban, isn't there?
Yeah, a lot of countries are just ignoring that ban. I mean, you can go into Khartoum, and you can find a friend, an acquaintance of mine who is the world's expert on ivory, told me that he went to Khartoum and was able to count 50,000 pieces of ivory being sold openly in the marketplace there. And so the people have forgotten that a necklace made out of ivory causes the death of an elephant. So the Southern African countries are trying to overturn the ban. They're stockpiling their ivory, and then some of them are just ignoring it.
I see. Carl has a question for you now.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I just love your stories, and to me, the elephant, the magic of the elephant knows no bounds.
Yeah.
And I was born in Africa. And of course, the culling of the animals in South Africa is being promoted. They want to do that. Do you have an idea of the impact that it will have on ivory in Zimbabwe and South Africa? I mean, if they want to legalize that again, and how many animals are being slaughtered to cull? I know the WWF was involved with that. In establishing a number of elephants to be culled?
Well, I was in South Africa exactly 2 years ago, and I was working with some South African conservationists who had elephants on a reserve, and they were using contraception to use on their elephants because the South African government says that the elephants in their large Kruger Park and by Kruger Park, that's where most of their elephants live, and it's not like we would think of it as a park. It's huge. It's as big as a country. And so these conservationists introduced the idea of contraception to the officials of Kruger Park, who said, well, what's in it for us? Mm-hmm. And so that really revealed that it's in their economic wishes to use elephants for the ivory, for skin and for meat. And so right now the head of the environment and the minister of environment and tourism, this man by the name of Van Schlawick, and I know I'm not pronouncing his name right, has organized a group of scientists to explore how they will handle the so-called overpopulation of elephants in Kruger Park. They have 12,000 elephants there, and so he wants to slaughter about half of them.
And how many is that? I believe that they wanting to enlarge the Kruger Park to include areas in Mozambique.
Yeah, that's called the Peace Park, where they dry up some of the water holes in Kruger Park so that the elephants have to move other places to find water. So that is one of the options that they're looking at. But Cynthia Moss, who has worked with elephants for decades in Amboseli National Park in Kenya, where I also was, said that elephants will not eat themselves out of house and home. They are smart enough to know that if they are starting to overpopulate, they will pull back on their birth rates. So, you know, it's a matter of debate whether the elephants in Kruger Park are really overpopulating the park. I was there, and I did not see that problem.
Well, the elephants are actually on an endangered species list, I understand, and CITES has put them on a list in 1990. So that it seems a contradiction to me that these one of their main habitats is overpopulated, and when there's an endangered, they are endangered.
Well, the Southern African countries have removed elephants from classification 1 down to classification 2.
Oh, they've made that decision on their own,
or
did CITES agree to that? Or?
Oh, well, I don't know. I don't understand all the politics of that. But what happens in the back room is an official with South Africa will get together with an official from Japan and say, okay, if you will vote with me to reduce elephants, to take elephants off of the endangered species list, I will vote for you to be able to hunt whales.
I see.
So this kind of wheeling and dealing goes on in the back room where nobody is allowed to see. So many countries that don't even have elephants are making decisions about the elephants.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Now, a main question that I want to put to you is, what can the people in this country do to help preserve elephants?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Number one, don't ever go to the circus or any entertainment where they use elephants and exotic animals. Number two, try to get them out of zoos, especially the zoos where the elephants are, you know, in very small enclosures. Like there's this elephant in Alaska who's all by her lonesome, and elephants are family oriented. They live in herds. They love each other. They communicate. They delight. They go into great ecstasy when they see someone that may have only been gone for an hour. They will trumpet. They will squeal with delight, and their trunks will entwine each other, and they, in their excitement, they might even defecate. And so they need to be with other elephants, and that elephant is all by herself. So, you know, in this country, you can do that sort of thing. They can also write to the Minister of South Africa and encourage him not to kill any of those elephants in Kruger Park. And if people go on my website, the address is there.
Oh, give us that website, will you?
Okay. It's www.pachydermpower.org.
Okay, and pachyderm is P-A-C-H-Y-D-E-R-M. Power, all one word.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that...
We've got to get the...
Dot org.
Okay, good.
Pachydermpower.org.
Great.
The other thing that people can do is spend their tourist dollars in countries that protect their wild animals, like Kenya. Kenya is very progressive in their understanding. It's against the law there to shoot an elephant. Whereas in South Africa, Namibia, Zimbabwe, if you pay enough money, you can shoot an elephant. And in fact, in Zimbabwe, they are killing elephants to feed to a crocodile farm.
Oh, my goodness sakes.
Yeah.
Things get worse and worse. Now, there's one other big effort I know you're making is the children's campaign, and would you tell us about that?
Yes, I do a multimedia presentation about elephants in schools, both elementary all the way up to university. I can make it appropriate for any age. It's multimedia, so I use music, I do a little magic, I show live video, I show, you know, photographs, and it's entertaining and educational, and then I invite the children, if they want, and if the teachers approve, to join with me in my campaign to support elephants. And so they will write letters to the minister in South Africa, or they will write letters in support of the work of other elephant conservationists throughout Africa. So they are getting educated, and the children understand. They understand the magnificence of elephants and the necessity to take care of them and preserve them, because it's really their future that we're talking about.
And that would be wonderful if we had local school teachers in Vancouver getting their children writing letters.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can encourage that.
Sponsor me and bring me there. I'd be happy to come and do a presentation.
All right. And we
audience is too small and no distance too far.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you for that. Now, let's end on a happy note. Tell us about elephant humor, will you?
Okay. Mm-hmm. This is a wonderful story. In the reserve where I worked in South Africa, the conservationist told me this story. Now, one day they were out in their Land Rover. They were parked, and they were observing this wonderful big bull elephant by the name of Charles. and he was trying to push down a tree, but he wasn't able to. The tree was too big. So the conservationist thought that was very funny. They started laughing at him. Well, he picked up his head and turned and looked over his shoulder, noticed that they were laughing, and he just kind of sauntered over to a smaller tree that was close to their Land Rover and pushed it down on top of their Land Rover.
Wonderful.
And then with a toss of his trunk, he sauntered off, wiggling his old butt.
Wonderful story. Oh, it's been a delight to have you, Crystal. I hope
thank
you'll
you.
Join us again at a later date. Maybe
yes,
give us some updates on the what's happening in the elephant world.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to an interview with Crystal Parks, an animal activist living in Denver, Colorado. And to read more about her work, you can go to www.pachydermpower.org. We have some music, Alan?
It was nice hearing some of that information about Asia earlier on in that interview about Thailand, because May is Asian Heritage Month here in British Columbia and all over the world. And so saluting Asian Heritage Month and the fact that today, May 4th, is Nature Day in Japan, something you probably didn't know, but it is. And so in honor of that, we're going to have a little Japanese music.
And you're listening to Animal Voices here on CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. Well, if it's good enough for John Ralston Saul and his wife and Rideau Hall, I have here a book on Rideau Hall, which is Government House, where the Governor General lives. And you know, they have an organic vegetable garden. And they have it for very good reasons, because as John Ralston Saul writes, the vegetable garden at Rideau Hall has developed into something of a demonstration garden, a demonstration of what you can do when you respect the site and acknowledge the local climate. And that automatically means a garden that uses no chemical fertilizers or pesticides or herbicides, namely an organic garden. A lot of people seem to have the impression that organic gardening is some kind of funky, funny thing to do when you grow, where you grow spotty fruits and tiny vegetables. When they take a tour of the kitchen garden here and they ask, why does everything look so healthy and big? The answer is that these things belong here. When you use chemicals, it becomes possible to pretend that you're somewhere else. But ironically, the more naturally you grow things and the more attuned to the place you become, the more your horizons expand. The growing season starts to get longer and it seems less artificial. The cooks here are now harvesting as early as the first week in May. For example, the gardeners start the lettuce under plastic tents as soon as the snow melts, until well after the first frost, right through to the middle of November. Certain vegetables love a touch of frost, like Brussels sprouts and butternut squash. It actually makes them taste sweeter. You'll be amazed at how much food we serve to Rideau Hall guests that comes out of the kitchen garden. It's because the gardeners haven't pretended that they're someplace else. They work with the site and embrace the fact that we live in a northern country. Wonderful. And if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for the rest of the country, surely. Come on, government, let's wake up.
Good for you, John. Now we are over to Carl.
Yes, and let's keep on the I really just loved that wonderful interview about and all the anecdotes about elephants that we had with your interview, Marge. So we'll keep to African animals. Mm-hmm. And I also recognize that story about the elephant that saved the baby rhinoceros that got stuck in the mud.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes.
So, anyway, but there are different types of rhinoceros. And the Sumatran rhino is the smallest of all the rhinoceros species and is found in Malaysia and, of course, the Indonesian islands of Borneo and Sumatra. Well, these small rhinoceros are on the critically endangered species list. And it's because they're of the destruction of their habitat and poaching, and that has been the result. Some 70% of their population has been destroyed, leaving only some 300 animals left in the wild. Well, there is a special rhino sanctuary set up in the wild in Sumatra, and it has failed to produce a single rhino baby since it opened in 1995. And efforts to get the species to reproduce in zoos, well, has been, why should they reproduce in zoos and confine their offspring to confinement, of course, is what we ask the question, is so they have not been able to reproduce at all. So they had a Sumatran rhino at the Los Angeles Zoo, and the independent newspaper in the UK talked about Underlast, the rhino, is on a mission. It has been sent from Los Angeles Zoo to the wilds of Sumatra to defend his male honor and do what it takes to propagate his endangered species. In other words, he has been taken to the rhino equivalent of a singles bar and left to follow his natural desires. So much for the destruction of the habitat and many people's dedication to save these animals. So, I also have another story about animals, and of course that is that bullfighting is in serious decline in Spain. I think that's where it's originated. Marge, you went to a bullfight in Spain, didn't you?
No, not in Spain, in Mexico City, and it was a terrible experience.
Well, I went to one in 1967 in Barcelona, and of course, matador puts the spear in the bull's neck. And I was not a vegetarian at the time, but when the blood started flowing from this bull's nose, I was just so horrified. But now there's a group that, in Spain, in Barcelona, in fact, they've banned bullfighting. There's no more bullfighting in Barcelona.
Wonderful.
But it's still part of their cultural heritage. And so there's now a group who want to apply to UNESCO to have bullfighting a part of Spain's cultural heritage by the year 2010. And these people claim to have some 1,300 supporters in Spain and believe that this is part of their heritage and needs to be supported in spite of the dramatic decline in of this popularity of bullfighting in Spain. In fact, a Gallup poll in Spain last year showed that only 27% of the population expressed an interest in bullfighting, as opposed to 55% in 1971. So there's a changing consensus there in the people who, and I certainly hope that these people won't jump on the bandwagon of heritage to perpetuate this horrendous cruelty.
There's also the cultural heritage of the Inquisition. We don't want to bring that back, do we?
Tell me about the Inquisition. Do we need to have fewer people on the planet?
On the rack? Well, there might be some that would fit it very nicely.
What happened in the Inquisition, John? Hmm? It was a war in Europe, the Inquisition? maybe...
Oh, well, the Inquisition, of course, was a church persecuting heretics and putting them to death in various inhuman ways, by fire or by pulled apart by horses and whatnot.
So it's not a good idea to be considered to be a heretic.
No.
Another interesting thing is we spoke earlier about the fish swimming in a cesspool of sewage outside or underneath the Lionsgate Bridge in Vancouver. But here was another interesting report, which was that to save the ocean stocks, in fact, the United States, and this is a good news story. Let's have a good news story. And it said that the United States wants to ban fishing subsidies. Well, so many countries perpetuate these fishing with long line methods and send them all over the world. And it's perpetuated with government approval, with government subsidies, much like the seal hunt in Canada is supported by so much federal and provincial, in certain provinces, promotions that this is the best way to deal with, an industry that needs to survive. So it's been said in this article that fishing subsidies total some $30 to $34 billion a year. And this has been under scrutiny now at the World Trade Organization. I want to close off with one little remark, and Marge is getting anxious here, and she's with of course Richard, who will be on the Community Living show in at 2 o'clock, and he had this wonderful joke which is worthwhile repeating. Richard, you said to me, why do cows wear bells? And you know what? I didn't know. And you told me it's because their horns don't work. And I want to say in closing, our webpage is www.animalvoices.org, and saving just one animal won't change the world, but surely the world will change for that one animal.
Thank you for that, Carl. You are listening to CFRO 102.7 FM, and I want to say thank you so much for all of those listeners who provided financial contributions in order to keep Animal Voices on the air. And we did reach our quota, and CFRO went over the top of its quota. So this has been a very good fundraiser for the station. And thank you also for listening today to Animal Voices, and please tune in again next week, 12 o'clock, and we'll be back.
And I hope we haven't spoiled anyone's lunch.
I hope we have.
And with that, we're going to have to slip away into the sunset. I'd just like to remind you that those of you who did help Co-op Radio reach the quota, we need to get you to send in your pledge. Remember, the address here is 360 Columbia Street in Vancouver, V6A4J1. 360 Columbia Street, Vancouver, V6A4J1. And even if you didn't call in during the drive, even though we reached the quota, Co-op Radio still always needs more money. It takes a lot of money to run this place. You can still send in a check, even if you didn't call in during our drive, to that address, 360 Columbia, V6A4J1. So hang on, in just 1 minute, EcoShock is going to be with you.